Imagine you go to a furniture store, you buy a beautiful new bookshelf, you bring it home, and you set it up in your living room.
Right.
And you fill it with your favorite physical books. 3 years go by. Then one morning, you wake up, you walk into your living room, and the bookshelf is just gone.
Oh, man.
Your books are scattered all over the floor. You call the store, totally outraged, and they calmly explain that their licensing contract with the lumber supplier expired.
Wow.
So they had to remotely repossess your bookshelf.
Yeah.
And no, you can't have a refund.
Yeah, you would call the police because that is theft.
Exactly. But in the digital world, that exact scenario is happening every single day.
It's wild. It violates our most basic, you know, deeply ingrained understanding of what property actually is.
Yeah.
But the legal architecture governing our digital lives has just completely decoupled from our physical reality.
Welcome to the deep dive. Whether you're grinding through a commute, maybe pushing through a workout at the gym, or just taking a minute to actually understand the digital ecosystem we all live in, we are glad you're here. Quick note up front. This deep dive is produced by humans with the help of AI.
Yes, it is.
Okay, let's unpack this. Today, we're looking at a massive paradigm shift. We've basically abandoned physical media for an era of perpetual, yet highly revocable rentals.
Mm-hmm.
Looking at our stack of legal analyses, tech journalism, and court precedents, we're exploring a concept that's really defining the modern tech economy, the illusion of digital ownership.
And we are moving past the dry terms of service today to look at the real world fallout. I mean, gamers, movie lovers, software users, everyone is getting caught in this net.
Yeah.
And what's particularly fascinating is how this exact same technological friction is forcing three major legal systems into completely different ideological corners.
Which is crazy to see.
It is. You've got the United States, the European Union, and China. And they are looking at the exact same digital files and drawing wildly different conclusions about who actually owns them.
Right. Well, let's start with the United States, because the urgency here really hit a boiling point recently. I mean, people literally woke up to find their purchased libraries just decimated.
Oh, you were talking about Sony.
Yeah, Sony PlayStation.
Mm-hmm.
So in September 2026, Sony permanently deleted, I think it was 551 Studio Canal films and TV shows from users' video libraries.
Mm-hmm.
These are classics like Terminator 2 and beloved family films like Paddington.
Paddington, yeah.
Like if you paid $20 to, quote unquote, buy Paddington on your PlayStation, Sony wiped it from your account. Zero refunds. Zero compensation.
It's gone.
Just gone. And they had actually tried a similar stunt with Discovery Network content a couple of years earlier, but the public backlash forced a 30-month delay.
Right. They backed off for a bit.
Yeah, but with Studio Canal, they didn't blink. The movies just vanished.
Well, and Sony could only pull that off because of how U.S. courts interpret end-user license agreements, or EULAs.
EULAs, right. The fine print nobody reads.
Exactly. As anyone who has ever skimmed a terms of service document knows, the EULA completely supersedes traditional property rights. When you click buy now on a digital storefront, you are not engaging in a sale of goods.
Right.
You are purchasing a revocable license that's pegged entirely to back-end server contracts. So if Sony's distribution deal with Studio Canal expires, your license just evaporates with it.
Now, if you're listening to this and thinking, well, wait, I paid for it. Shouldn't copyright law protect my purchase just like a physical CD?
Mm-hmm.
People have actually tried to fight that battle in court.
Oh, yeah, they have.
And it brings us to a really crucial piece of case law. Capitol Records v. Redigi.
Redigi is the perfect test case for this. They were a secondary marketplace, essentially trying to invent a used record store for digital iTunes MP3s. They understood copyright law, specifically the first sale doctrine, which is the legal principle that allows you to buy a physical book or CD and then legally resell it at a garage sale.
Right, like the creator got their money the first time.
Exactly. The copyright holder gets paid for the first sale, but their control ends there.
So Redigi figured if they could guarantee the digital file didn't duplicate, they were legally in the clear to facilitate resales.
That was the gamble.
Yeah.
Yeah. They built this highly sophisticated forward and delete protocol.
Forward and delete.
Right. So when you sold your MP3 on Redigi, their software transferred the data packets to the buyer while simultaneously scrubbing them from your hard drive.
So it's never in two places.
The file never existed in two places at once.
Okay.
They argued they were just executing a digital first sale.
Wait, okay, so if I hand you a physical book, no copyright is violated.
Right.
But if I use software to perfectly replicate handing you a digital book while simultaneously deleting mine, it's illegal just because the underlying mechanism involves making a temporary copy on a new hard drive. That feels like applying 19th century property law to 21st century physics. I mean, it's absurd.
It really is. But that tension is exactly what the Second Circuit Court of Appeals wrestled with. And they ultimately rejected Redigi's argument.
Shot it down?
They did. The court ruled that because transferring a digital file inherently requires fixing that data onto a new material object, so the recipient's hard drive, it involves creating a reproduction.
Ah, I see.
Yeah. So the first sale doctrine protects your right to distribute a physical object you own, but it explicitly does not grant you the right to reproduce it.
Even if you delete the original.
Even with simultaneous deletion, the court decided an unauthorized copy was made. So in the digital realm, you basically cannot transfer without copying, which means the first sale doctrine essentially doesn't exist for digital files in the U.S.
Wow. So the U.S. courts basically killed the legal concept of digital ownership right there.
Pretty much.
If you can't transfer it without breaking copyright, you don't own it.
Mm.
The corporation holds all the cards, which totally explains California's new law.
Right. Assembly Bill 2426.
Yeah, the Digital Goods Transparency Act, which kicked in this past January. Because if they can't change federal copyright law, I guess their only weapon left is consumer protection, just forcing companies to admit they aren't actually selling anything.
That is the exact pivot. So AB 2426 dictates that storefronts like Steam, PlayStation, Xbox, they can no longer use terms like buy or purchase if they are only granting a revocable license.
That makes sense.
Unless they offer a permanent offline download, they have to explicitly warn users in plain language before checkout that access could be revoked.
So it doesn't actually stop Sony from deleting Paddington?
No, not at all. It just stops them from lying to you about your ownership status when you hand over your credit card.
Man. So the U.S. has basically settled for a warning label.
Yeah.
But if we cross the Atlantic to the European Union, the conversation shifts entirely. Like, the EU isn't just settling for transparency. They are actively fighting over the actual mechanics of what constitutes a quote-unquote sale.
And that fight has a deeply complicated history in European courts. If you look at EU case law, they have been dealing with this fascinating split personality.
How so?
Well, in 2012, in the landmark Usedsoft ruling, the highest EU court actually legalized the reselling of used software licenses.
Wait, really?
Yes. They determined that downloading a piece of software for a one-time fee constitutes a legal sale, which exhausts the developer's distribution rights.
Okay, so why did they view software differently than the U.S. courts viewed those iTunes MP3s?
Because they classified software as a functional tool. The court reasoned that making a temporary copy in RAM or on a hard drive is strictly necessary to use the tool you purchased.
Okay.
Therefore, the right to resell that tool supersedes the technicality of the copying process. But fast forward to 2019, and the Tom Cabinet ruling complicated everything.
Tom Cabinet, what was that?
Tom Cabinet was a Dutch marketplace for used ebooks.
Oh, I see where this is going.
Yeah, the courts looked at ebooks and said, no, this is different from software.
Wait, why did the court treat an ebook differently than software? Aren't they both just downloadable packets of data? I mean, that feels like a distinction without a difference to the consumer.
Visually, yes. I mean, they are both just files. But legally, the court ruled that an ebook is not a functional tool. It is media consumption.
Okay.
They classified delivering an ebook not as the distribution of a physical copy, but as a communication to the public.
A communication.
Right. Think of it less like handing someone a physical book and more like broadcasting a movie or a play. And under EU law, the right of communication to the public is not exhausted after the first sale.
Wow.
So you can legally resell a piece of software in the EU, but reselling an ebook, a digital movie, or a music file remains totally illegal.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because video games blur that line perfectly.
They do.
They are functional software tools, but they're also media consumption. And this exact ambiguity triggered a massive consumer uprising recently.
Oh, the Ubisoft situation.
Yes. So in March 2024, Ubisoft shut down the servers for a 2014 racing game called The Crew.
Right.
And this was an always online game. So even if you were just playing the single player campaign alone in your living room, the game required a constant handshake with Ubisoft servers.
Mm-hmm.
So when Ubisoft pulled the plug on the servers, the game didn't just lose multiplayer, it was completely bricked. Even if you owned the physical disc, it became a useless piece of plastic. And UFC Qui Choisir, which is a major French consumer rights group, launched a lawsuit over it.
And the fallout from The Crew shutting down was unprecedented. It birthed a global citizen movement called Stop Destroying Video Games.
I remember seeing that online.
Yeah, they launched a formal European Citizens Initiative. They gathered roughly 1.3 million verified signatures across the EU, arguing that destroying a game after commercial support ends violates consumer rights and just outright destroys cultural art.
Yeah.
Their demand was a legal mandate forcing publishers to patch games at the end of their life cycle so they can remain playable offline or on private servers.
I mean, as a player, that logic is bulletproof.
Yeah.
You bought the product. It shouldn't have an artificial kill switch just because the company wants to redirect their server budget.
Exactly.
But on the flip side, I mean, keeping servers alive or re-engineering code costs serious money.
It does. And the European Commission had to weigh that exact economic reality in their formal response in June 2026. Ultimately, the commission declined to create a binding mandate to keep games playable.
Really?
Yeah. They said forcing developers to release server architecture could severely compromise their proprietary intellectual property. Plus, for like small or mid-size indie studios, the engineering costs to retrofit an always online game for offline play at the end of its commercial life could literally bankrupt them.
Yeah, that makes sense.
The commission decided the burden on creators was just disproportionately high.
So they essentially backed off the mandate.
They did, but consumer advocates immediately pivoted their strategy. They are now heavily lobbying for provisions in the upcoming Digital Fairness Act, which is expected in late 2026. Instead of demanding endless server support, they want this new act to tackle post-sale restrictions under general consumer protection law.
Oh, that's smart.
Yeah, they argue that unilateral feature degradation, like bricking a game's single-player mode without prior warning, is an unfair commercial practice and should be regulated as such.
So the West is really trapped in this binary struggle.
Very much so.
In the U.S., contract law reigns supreme, and consumers just get a warning label at checkout. In the EU, they're locked in a regulatory tug of war between consumer fairness and corporate copyright.
Yep.
But China has sidestepped this binary entirely. They've constructed a radically different legal architecture to solve the digital ownership problem.
China has taken a highly pragmatic approach, and it fundamentally separates the physical infrastructure of the internet from the value generated by the user.
Okay, how does that work?
Well, Chinese courts have firmly established that virtual goods, so video game accounts, in-game cosmetics, digital items, microtransactions, they possess real, legally recognized economic value.
Wow.
They classify these as virtual commodities, and importantly, they're protected as inheritable property.
Wait, inheritable? So someone could theoretically spend years grinding for gear and then leave their stacked World of Warcraft account to their kid in their will.
Precisely. And this is where the jurisprudential split happens, which is actually brilliant in its mechanics. The courts acknowledge that the publisher owns the physical infrastructure, the company owns the servers, the proprietary base code, the intellectual property of the game itself.
Right.
However, the consumer legally owns the right of use. Over the years, as a player invests time and money into an account, that accumulated right of use becomes their protected property. A company's terms of service cannot legally override statutory inheritance or trading laws.
Man, it sounds a bit like real estate.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like buying a condo in a high-rise building. You own the inside of the condo, the right of use, and you can sell it, decorate it, or leave it to your kids.
Mm-hmm.
But the publisher owns the high-rise building itself. If they decide to demolish the whole building, your condo goes down with it. But as long as the building is standing, the landlord cannot tell you who you are allowed to hand your keys to.
That is exactly how it functions. Now, we do have to frame this within the broader political and regulatory reality of China.
Sure.
The state maintains heavy security and oversight over the tech sector. There are strict bans on financial speculation, like unregulated crypto tokens, so they are explicitly not turning video games into unregulated stock markets.
Okay, that makes sense.
And to your condo analogy, China does not force a company to keep dead servers alive. If a game becomes unprofitable and shuts down, the building is demolished and you still lose your virtual property.
Right.
But the vital distinction is that while the service lives, the company cannot use a ULA to strip you of your property rights over your account.
It is such a fascinating contrast to the West. The U.S. says the ULA is absolute king. China's courts are saying no, user-generated value is real, and a corporate contract cannot vaporize property law.
If you connect this to the bigger picture, we are basically watching the global legal system fracture in real time as it tries to catch up with the pace of technology.
Yeah.
The United States is enforcing transparency, basically ensuring you know you are just a renter. The European Union is trying to find a philosophical middle ground, balancing intellectual property against consumer fairness. And China has carved out an entirely new property class, separating the underlying code from the utility of the code.
So what does this all mean for the listener? Well, the next time you're scrolling through your digital storefront and you go to click that buy button, I want you to read the prompt carefully.
Definitely.
Take a second to realize that you are participating in a massive, shifting, global legal experiment. You aren't just buying a game or a movie. You are engaging in a highly complex licensing transaction that lawmakers across the planet are actively fighting over.
And we have to remember that the technology driving this friction is only moving faster.
Oh, absolutely.
We've spent this time talking about digital files, you know, movies, games, software vanishing from our accounts. But the hardware infrastructure itself is shifting under our feet.
Which brings me to a final, slightly terrifying thought that was buried in our research today. We caught a brief glimpse of the future with the shutdown of Google Stadia, their cloud gaming service.
Oh, right.
When Google killed Stadia, all the digital games obviously vanished. But people were left with these physical plastic Stadia controllers sitting in their living rooms, which were designed to only connect via Wi-Fi to dead Google servers.
Just useless plastic.
Yeah. Now, to their credit, Google released a final firmware update to unlock the Bluetooth on those controllers so people could use them on their PCs, which prevented a huge mountain of e-waste.
That was a good move.
It was. But it begs a huge question. As we move further into cloud-based gaming, remote processing, and smart appliances that require server verification, is the next battleground for digital ownership not even about the software vanishing?
Mm-hmm.
Is it about companies having the remote power to permanently brick the physical hardware sitting right in our hands when the license expires?
It's the ultimate convergence of physical and digital property. When the software license expires, does the physical object you bought become a paperweight just by corporate decree?
It brings us right back to our bookshelf.
Yeah.
It's not just the books disappearing from the shelf anymore. We are moving toward a future where they can remotely vaporize the bookshelf itself.
It's really wild.
Something to think about the next time you blindly hit accept on those terms and conditions. That is all for this deep dive. Keep questioning the fine print.